Look at what's going on in the last 100 days. Economic expansion, closing Guantanamo, ending torture, reducing our troops to zero, basically, in Iraq, building up our forces in Afghanistan, rejoining the world. That's pretty big. I think this president in his first 100 days has launched into an area which we don't know the answer to, which is, can he do it all?
Let me make a gentle reminder that during the question and answer half of the hour, we ask that you ask brief questions. And the rule here is just the same as it is on Jeopardy. It has to be in the form of a question, not a statement. Let me also recognize over on the left side here, the students of Concord University in West Virginia, who came at the crack of dawn to get here by 9 o'clock and get good seats. At Concord University, they have a course that requires the students to watch all of the Miller Center forums each week. And then they discuss them and work with them. And so once a year or so, they come over here and they visit in person. And we're glad to have you here. It's a great way that you stay on top of current events. So thank you very much for being here. I also want to acknowledge my good friend, Mortimer Kaplan. Mort Kaplan, as many of you know, was Commissioner of the Internal Revenue. Not a bad person, though. During the John F. Kennedy administration, and was on the law faculty here for many years, and now is the senior partner of the leading tax firm in the United States, Kaplan and Drysdale. Mort Kaplan is a good friend of Chris Matthews, and he interceded and encouraged Chris to come down here. I think he said he'd report him to the IRS if he didn't, wouldn't he? Well, our guest today is Chris Matthews. Chris Matthews is a graduate of Holy Cross College, and he did graduate work in economics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He served 2 years in the Peace Corps in Africa. He spent 5 years as a Senate staffer for Frank Moss of Utah and Edmund Muskie of Maine. He ran for Congress in 1974 in the Democratic primary in Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District. He was a speechwriter in the White House for Jimmy Carter, and then for 6 years, he was the administrative assistant, the top aide to Speaker of the House, Thomas P. Tip O'Neill. Chris Matthews spent much of his career as a newspaper journalist, 13 years as the Washington bureau chief for the San Francisco Examiner, and then 2 years as a national columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's the author of 5 books, and his latest, Life's a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success, was published in 2007. But Chris Matthews is perhaps best known for his television news programs as the host of Hardball on MSNBC and The Chris Matthews Show on NBC. He received the David Brinkley Award for Excellence in Broadcast Journalism, one of the highest recognitions in the business. Please welcome Chris Matthews.
Thank you. Well, the last time I spoke with this gentleman, I gave the commencement address at, one of the 2 commencement addresses at Washington College. And as I was about to brag about my 2 years in Africa in the Peace Corps, I was preceded by a gentleman who described what it was like to land on Omaha Beach. It's a hard act to follow. Thank you for your service, and everyone else here who served in the military. This fellow was actually there, landing at Normandy on, what was it, D-Day? D-Day. It's hard to batch that. I want to talk about history today, the first 100 days of this administration. I've been lucky as a journalist. I mean, all that political stuff aside, I was lucky as a journalist to cover the fall of the Berlin Wall. I was there, and I remember interviewing a young German who I asked him what freedom meant to him, was ist Freiheit, and he said, talking to you. So sometimes in your life, you get to see your values confirmed. The Cold War was a good war. We won. They lost, definitely. And I think Reagan deserves a lot of credit for that, and a lot of other people like Harry Truman, Jack Kennedy. I was there in South Africa for the first time that blacks were allowed to vote, and I watched those biblical lengths of lines of people voting on a hot day, people waiting in line for hours, and all because Mandela told them that democracy was the way to do it, not war. And I remember interviewing a young woman who said, "This is the day I waited for my whole life," and she was white. The world's filled with good people. I was in Northern Ireland during the great Good Friday Accords, and I come from both sides, Protestant and Catholic, and my grandparents, I had one of my grandmothers was Mrs. Doubtfire, actually. You would think so. She had the stature and the brogue, and she was the Protestant one, and the other side was the Catholic one, so I come from both of that, and to see that come together over there was really inspiring, and to see the tough Protestant guys at Ulster Hall and the good Catholics like John Hume really working for peace, and that seems to be working out. They don't like each other yet, by the way. They still haven't gotten there yet, but they aren't killing each other, which is quite a development. And I was there for the Pope's funeral, another great moment to see how things work. The reason that Pope, John Paul II, was popular, people always underestimate the power of politics. When he became Pope, but Bishop of Rome, he decided that he would be their true Bishop of Rome, not just formally. And he decided he would visit a parish each weekend. And he committed himself to like 225 parishes in Rome. And every weekend on a Saturday night, he would have dinner with the pastor. And the next day, meet with the students in the hall and go to and say the mass. So he did this up to about 170 or so parishes before he got Parkinson's. And that's why they liked him. He had 3 million people waiting in line when he passed away. It was quite an event. And so I've covered a lot of history, but I don't think anything matches what we're covering right now. I think something really, who would have believed an African-American president? Who would have believed that he would have this stunning family, that he would be elegant, that he would be matchable to the office so far, to the point where nobody mentions ethnicity. It hasn't come up, which shows how quickly this country does adapt. Nobody's talked about him being black or not since he's been president. It's very interesting. I don't think anybody mentioned Kennedy's religion once he was president. We get over these hurdles, and you never know when you're going to break through a barrier until you've done it. You never know looking ahead. You never know what's coming. But when it comes, you go, well, that's something else we got past, and it seems to be working out all right. I have my mixed views about it. By the way, America is a country of mixed views. I like it here. You're allowed to have a mixed view. Because that's what most of politics is about. It's the idiots that think everything is simple. I can list the television shows they prefer. Right and left. The ditto heads are not all on the right. I hope nobody watches me and says I'm a ditto head. Please yell occasionally in anger or love or whatever. Look at what's going on. In the last 100 days, I mean, an economic expansion. Well, first of all, the dollar, the printing of money. You got to wonder about this. But in a worldwide deflation, maybe that's the right answer. When the whole world economy, I mean, real estate is still dropping. It's still going down around the world. The prices of everything is dropping around the world. And as the president pointed out a couple weeks ago, if the consumer spends less money because it makes common sense and business invests less because they got to be practical, somebody's got to make up for that. And so we have an expansion of the money supply. That's the monetary piece of this. We have an $800 billion stimulus package, which is the fiscal end of it. We've got this capitalization of the banks. We've got this public-private effort to try to buy up these toxic assets. By the way, there's a phrase I never want to hear again. There are two dark corners of the world today. One is the old Northwest Frontier province of Pakistan, which used to be the northwest frontier of India. It's where Churchill had his first big fight in the Malakand Field Campaign in 1897. And it's still dangerous, still uncontrolled by the central government over there. And the other dark corner of the world is the banking industry, which I have no idea what's going on in it, but I hope we don't hear about it in a couple of years. Then we'll know we're all right. If we don't hear the word toxic assets, at least. And so he's trying to deal with all of that. In addition, in the first 100 days, closing Guantanamo, ending torture, reducing our troops to zero, basically, in Iraq, building up our forces in Afghanistan, rejoining the world, that's pretty big. He did that. I mean, we're actually acting like a member of the World of Nations now, actually getting along with people. They're not all nice people, by the way. Sarkozy's a mixed bag. I think Merkel's okay. Gordon Brown's not exactly exciting. I think he's winning, our guy's winning the charisma contest right now. Especially against some of the uglier people in the world, like Chavez. So I'd like my picture taken with Chavez, because you're always going to look better. So that's not a bad move. Come on over here, buddy. Let's get another shot. A little close up this time. They put him up there next to Noriega. They could have a duel. No, I think that didn't hurt either. I think he shouldn't have listened to Ortega doing his 45-minute rant against us. But then again, Ortega got elected. Isn't that what we believe in? So we put up with people who get elected. We don't have to like them, but that's the way we do it. So he beat Uno finally down there. So things are changing. You can't predict any of this stuff. On the social front, we've got federal supports for stem cell. The don't ask, don't tell thing I thought would be the biggest thing in the world. They're starting to change that in the military. Nobody even mentions it anymore. So how do these things change so like that? We don't even argue about it. We've got the gag rule on overseas support for non-government organizations that help people with child reproductive rights and all that stuff. That's gone. Same-sex I don't know if we're ever going to start debating this. It's a good thing to debate same-sex. We're all traditional in many ways, and I can argue about it. I haven't said anything one way or the other on the issue really firmly. And my belief is these are the things we debate as a society, and we discuss, and we get used to, or we don't get used to. We argue against, or we argue for. It's not going to kill anybody. It's a reasonable discussion. We'll have it, and we can live through it. But at least we don't have people sitting around the White House in the middle of the night darkly figuring how they can exploit anger over the issue. That's better. We don't have people like Karl Rove thinking about how we can get some people to hate some other people more. That's probably better, just a guess. Also, I think this president in his first 100 days has launched into an area which we don't know the answer to, which is, can he do it all? Can he do health care, which the Democrats have been talking about since Harry Truman, since the beginning of the Cold War, we've been talking about health care. I have a cameraman who, he's my floor director, he works about, Brooke Brower, by the way, is here, one of your great graduates down here. He's one of my top producers at the network. Brooke Brower, class of 00, right? He's here. He helps me with it. He's my brain trust. Hold your applause. This is a tough crowd here. Jesus. Anyway, one of my other people I work with, a fellow who doesn't have health insurance. So there are people in these major corporations that they manage to not insure. And I think about that every time I'm on the air. Here's a guy with kids who gets the kids taken care of with Medicare, but he has to go to ER if he gets in trouble. And he's healthy right now, but this is something we all work with. We work with people who catch the bus at 6 in the morning and don't have health care. It's not like they're bums. People work very hard in Washington, D.C. Poor people, they actually get Medicare, but it's the working people that make it a minimal income or a decent income at a low level that don't get health care, and they're the ones I'm worried about. So I don't see any reason. Anybody been to ER lately, to an ER? It's 2 hours. It's not an emergency, it's 2 hours. I had malaria, sit there, wait for 2 hours. But I was in a terrible situation, but I do think that we have to get past that. So we have this tremendous push for greatness in one term. I want to talk about the strategies this guy's following. And then of course the auto industry, no small potatoes, they are trying to save GM. We just lost Pontiac over the weekend. Isn't that sad? Pontiacs were a hot car. I like Pontiac, especially the convertible, 67. You remember the great years? Remember when kids grew up, it was like every kid knew what the new models were and you couldn't wait to see them. And if your parents or anybody knew got a new car, it was the biggest thing in the world. And new car smell was the coolest smell in the world. And what happened? Why are we not cool anymore? Anyway, I don't think we do that over hybrids. You're not that quite that excited. Not quite excited. But we're trying to save GM, and Chrysler's been forced. It's like a shotgun. They're supposed to marry Fiat. Marry Fiat! You know, it's like the strangest rule. You go marry that Italian guy. You know, I mean, it's like it's the strangest kind of requirement for survival. If you don't get hitched up in 3 months, you're out of here. It's amazing. That's the president. So things are happening for better or worse. But let me go through what I think are the strategies, and then I'd love to take your questions. I have about three strategies. I'm always thinking about this stuff. Brooke and I think about these things. What's going on? What's the theme here? What's the shape of this elephant? What's he doing this for? I always try, every night, what are they up to? That's what we do in Hardball. Well, one thing is, I think this guy, our new president, I'm casual about him. I always get in trouble calling him Barack, you know. Barack sounds better than Obama, so I call him Barack, but I'm supposed to call him President Obama. But my respect is there and implicit, I hope. I think he's a student. I think more than our recent president. Dare I say that? just guessing. They're not equal. President George W. Bush is a very intelligent guy, and if anybody didn't think so, watch them take down the press every time he met with him. He's smart. He just wasn't curious. That's a problem. And you got to be curious. There's a lot of complicated things going on out there, and you got to try to figure them out. And I think this new guy tries to figure them out. He may be wrong, he may be elite, he may be all kinds of things we don't like, but I think one thing he does is he has intellectual curiosity. And that's a good thing in this complicated time. And I think one thing he does is try to be Lincoln. I mean, if you're black in America, it seems like you gotta like Lincoln. You know, he wasn't exactly an abolitionist, but he was as close as we ever got in the White House. He wasn't John Brown, but he was pretty close in terms of his sentiment. And he did believe slavery was wrong. By the way, my latest hero is U.S. Grant. I know I'm in Virginia, but I really think Grant is a fascinating character. I want Russell Crowe to play him in the movies. I think he looks like Russell Crowe. Lincoln believed that you had to bring your rivals in. I owe this to Doris Kearns Goodwin, but bringing your rivals in, and in his case, he had to build a coalition government with the Whigs and the abolitionists. He had to bring the establishment people like Jim Baker in, you know, Seward. And then he had to bring in the wild, crazy abolitionist types and bring them all together. And so he did it with Seward and Chase and the rest of them, and he got them all working together. I think whether it's a true story or not, it's certainly a thesis, and it's Doris Kearns Goodwin's, and I think it's Barack. I think the most stunning thing since the election was the naming of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. It stunned me. It was not a group decision by the Obama campaign. I don't think the people who worked in that campaign had any desire to bring her in. Bring her people in with her. I mean, there's certainly, you got Rahm Emanuel in the White House running the White House, who's at least as much of a Clinton person as he is a Barack person. You got John Podesta there. You got Richard Holbrooke, who would have been big no matter who won. A lot of influence from the Clintons in this White House. It's truly a coalition government. I think there's two big reasons why I picked Hillary Clinton, apart from intelligence, ability, all that sort of thing, and her basic competence. And her hard work ethic, she does have that. One, I think, on the Middle East. I think if this president is to make his name in history, he's going to have to pull off a Middle East deal up there with Carter. Something that brings the Mahmoud Abbas government, Fatah, in with Israel and some kind of a deal on the Middle East. And deal with Hamas as part of that government, somehow. To do that, he's gonna have to deal with Bibi Netanyahu, who is a hard right, Likudnik. He's the only world leader, by the way, with a Philadelphia accent, which I find somewhat warming. But he does have a Philly accent. To do that, he's going to have to carry the people who are very pro-Israeli in this country, who are very pro-Likudnik. He's going to have to bring in people like Mort Zuckerman, head of the Jewish organizations. He's going to need the Clintons as his signatory. He's going to need them to underwrite the deal. I think he was very smart, knowing the guy named Barack Hussein Obama wasn't going to be able to cut the deal with Israel. He's going to need people who are known to be pro-Israeli, and that's the Clintons. And I think that Bill Clinton will have to play a part in this as well. And I watched this come to fruition this past weekend, where Hillary Clinton went to Bibi Netanyahu and said, stop talking about Iran and a strategic threat from Iran, because unless you deal with the Middle East and the Palestinian thing, you're not going to get our help, you're not going to get a deal. Unless you deal with your own piece of land over there and start sharing it, nothing's going to happen. The Arab world, the West, is not going to unite against Iran. It's not going to happen. So she stuck it to him. And he's, of course, saying, deal with Iran first. We want to go attack Iran. We'll see if that happens. So that's very strong stuff. But I think the other part of the Clinton coalition, and it truly is a coalition government, this isn't just a personnel appointment, is the economics. Anyone who watches the stock market, by the way, you all do, and it drives you crazy, I'm sure. We keep hoping for a ratchet effect of 8,000, right? Like it's going to stay up there? I don't know. Who knows? I lost a ton. Everybody has. I think that we don't know. And if it drops down again, and unemployment continues to rise, which it probably will through the end of this year, it's just a lagging indicator. We don't see any leading indicators coming the other way to give us hope. No green sprouts, we're calling them. And we still have this trouble with the banking industry, with the dark corner of that world still festering. We're going to need some strong political backing. I believe the Clintons, Hillary Clinton won 18 million votes in the Democratic fight last year. 18 million people, working class white people mainly, not the college types. The college types generally voted for Barack Obama. You could predict every primary caucus by the percentage of voters who went to 4 years of college, and wherever it was high, he walked away with it. Wherever it was low, she won big. So when times continue to be tough, I think he needs the Clintons to back him up. And so I think, because think about her, if she were a New York senator right now, every bit of economic bad news, the press would run to her and say, what do you think, Senator? And she'd be a lightning rod of opposition. Eventually, she would be like Ted Kennedy was with Carter, just the person you go to complain with. And no matter what she said, it would be unhelpful to Carter. So I do think that the Clintons are there for both reasons, for coalition building on foreign policy, and more subtly, domestic economic policy. Because if you have the Clintons and the Obama crowd together, you've got the Democratic Party. There's no one else there. There is no more trouble. Right now, 97% of the Democratic Party supports everything Barack's doing. I've never seen party unity like this. No, there's no bipartisanship. None. But there is huge partisanship, which if you're a big party like the Democratic Party and you can hold together the Mary Landrews and the Ben Nelsons and the Bill Nelsons and the Kay Hagans, if you can keep all them aboard, you've got a hell of a coalition going. So it really is not a bipartisan coalition. It's a Democratic coalition of a party that could easily have been divided. Just remember what Will Rogers said. I'm a member of no organized political party. I'm a Democrat. And that isn't true anymore. This is the United Party. So the Clintons, one of those strange deals in the night where he somehow, you know, I'm a true romantic. I am. And I was crying the night that Jimmy Smits offered the Secretary of State job to Alan Alda. I don't know about you, but I was taken with that more than I am with this one, in fact. I like those two people better. I really like Jimmy Smits. Of course, I was rooting for Alan Alda, because he, only in the stupidness of Hollywood scripts, why, he shines his own shoes. Well, who did he expect to shine his shoes? I keep thinking, has he got a valet at home? Anyway, he doesn't. So I was like that. Maybe he's inspired by West Wing. Wouldn't that be funny? The pick Hillary. So that's the one model, team of rivals. And I think that's really been powerful, and certainly powerful in what didn't happen, a division of the party from the beginning. The Clinton older women my age, they're still mad at me. So I think they may be mad at some other people. Somebody agrees. Anyway, so there's a lot of bad feelings coming out of that campaign. I think he solved the problem. That's all right. That doesn't bother me. That's okay. No, please, please. You're like that guy in the movie preview when they said, baby's crying. That's right. Just kidding. So I think that that's really smart to keep that party united. The second thing is the Reagan model, which is unusual because he's from the other party. But Ronald Reagan proved that in the ADD world in which we live, you better do it if you're going to do it. You know, do it. I think that the sense that if he's going to do something on health care, do something on energy, cap and trade, and certainly on education, he better do it while he's got a hot hand. And he's got a hot hand now. If he puts it off, we've seen this before. I've worked on the Hill so many years. I've heard these old stories. Every year, in an odd number year, you better get it done. Because odd number years, we don't have elections. The minute you have an election coming up, then all the blue dog Democrats, the conservative and moderate Democrats, who are really people who represent tricky districts for them, districts that went for McCain, for example, because that's what happens when your party grows. You get people with soft seats. That's what happens. You want a big party, that means you're going to have a lot of people who are in soft seats. If you want a tough party that can't be beaten and nobody can get beaten, have a small party. Like the Republicans aren't going to lose many seats from now on. Let's face it, they have lost all the seats they're going to lose. If you're a Republican congressperson right now, you're in good shape. You can't be beaten because you got through 06 and you got through 08. It's never going to be that bad. It's called atmospheric. It's never going to be that atmospherically bad. And so Ronald Reagan taught us, I mean, I was on the other side of that, with Speaker O'Neill. We watched Ronald Reagan come at us like a blitz. And he pushed everything, the big tax cuts, the big defense spending, the budget changes, everything in one year, and it worked. By his second year, he was foundering. He lost 26 seats in the House. We had something to do with that. And he ended up having to bring the taxes up again. And a lot of things he didn't want to do came later. He finally got through tax reform around 86 or so, 87. So he did manage to get some things done, but 85, actually. 86. But he,
86.
More Kaplan. But isn't H&R Block still a bigger deal than you? But that's a chain store. That's not what you do. 86. It took him a while to get that second footprint down. He got so much done the first year. So did LBJ. Let's face it, LBJ did civil rights in 64, voting rights in 65, one in a reaction to the Kennedy assassination, one in a reaction to his big reelection, where he won hugely. And so you have to hit while you're hot. And And I think that's the other lesson. And everybody says, well, wait your turn. Well, if Barack Obama had waited his turn, he wouldn't be a senator. Waiting your turn is what they told Jack Kennedy to do. The funny thing about American politics, it is youth-oriented. It is hot-hand stuff. The Republican Party is the party of wait your turn. And what a disaster it's been for them. These people keep getting nominated past the time they would have been good candidates. I mean, I said the other night on the show, John McCain would have been a great president in 2000. Dare I say the obvious? I don't think we would have made some of the mistakes we made with President Bush. I think we would have had just as much patriotism and been just as strong at fighting Iraq, or fighting, no, we wouldn't have gone into Iraq, but fighting the bad guys, Bin Laden under McCain. And we wouldn't have had this torture stuff and all the division. I mean, it's easy to look back. I think Bob Dole got nominated 20 years too late, the poor guy. Well, he was nominated in 76 for VP, and then he got nominated in 96. This wait your turn party, it's not working. Nixon got it, he would have been better in 60, although I'm not sure what happened in Cuba, by the way, but he would have been 8 years earlier. 8 years later, he was angry, and he was a little bit more like Edmond Dantes coming out of the Chateau d'If after 8 years. Well, you don't want to meet the Count of Monte Cristo. And so, Reagan model for get it done, Lincoln model for unite the forces. Now, here's the one that will cause trouble among Obamaites, the Chicago model. This guy is a Chicago Paul. I just had dinner with Richie the other night and the new governor. He is a Chicago Paul, meaning you have to sell one simple proposition and you have to keep selling it perpetually because it gets stuff done. You must tell the media, you must tell the opponents, and anyone who will listen, there's only one game in town, and that's me. What he does all the time, if you listen to Barack Obama, is say, there's only me, and there's the troublemakers out there. There's no alternative governing party. There's no moderate Republican Party waiting to take my place. There's no middle of the road Eisenhower Republican Party sitting out there, or even Reagan Party out there. There's just me and the crazies. Me and Rush Limbaugh. Me and angry Dick Cheney. Or Marilyn Bachman, or Rick Perry, the crazy governor of Texas who wants to secede. There's just nutcases out there. You'll notice, as far as I can tell, he never mentions the name of Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate. I don't think he mentions his name. He never mentions the name of John Boehner, the guy with the tan. Yeah. So he always looks like he's just thrown his cigarette down on the 13th green, you know. He always looks like he's taking a putt. He talks into his chin, by the way. John Boehner, the tan. You like that? A tan and a cigarette. Because he's either smoking or playing golf or getting a tan. I don't know. Anyway, that guy, they never mention him. So what I think he's up to is what Boss Daley in Chicago did all those years. Just as just me and the troublemakers. There's Jesse Senior and Bill Singer and all those wacky lefties the media likes. But there's nobody that can govern except me. And now they can sustain this idea for a while because they have the most seats in the House and the Senate. They don't have enough to pass to beat a filibuster, but they got a lot. And so what I think he's up to is just keeping that, and Rahm Emanuel, boy, is he tough. He knows what he's doing. By the way, everything I'm saying here, he'd grumble and say, you may be right, but you guys think you know everything, you know, but maybe we do. I mean, Rahm Emanuel says, I never let a crisis go to waste. So he uses that. So I really do think there's a lot of smarts with this guy on those three levels. What else? I think that if you look at history, that Barack's got it figured out pretty well. If you look at our history, going back, what all we can remember, really, and what we've grown up with, 32, we had the Great Depression, and we had Hoover, a smart guy who couldn't deal with the fact of deflation. But smart, just he couldn't deal with deflation. He didn't have an answer to it. He said, cut spending, throw up the tariff wall, Smoot-Hawley, that sort of thing. Didn't have the answer. So what did the public do? They said, well, we need a big decision. And so we picked somebody we normally would have picked. A person described as having a second-rate mind, a person seen as a dilettante with a famous name, and he became, I think, our greatest president. Because we had a big crisis, we made a big decision, and then we made a big change. And I think that's always intuitive. Whenever the American people see a big challenge, they know something's really wrong, and whoever's been running the country's got it really wrong. And so they say, let's have a big decision to pick someone we normally wouldn't pick, and let them have the reins for a while. Let them do what they want to do. Don't just put them in there and have them muddle through and go back to the way it was three weeks ago. Don't ask them to be what we had. That's the thing the media keeps forgetting. The public, when they make a big decision after a big crisis, wants a big change. They do not want the same. The press, oh, just cut spending, cut taxes, blah, 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 the same old sort of Jerry Ford, middle down, muddle down the middle. When Reagan came in, big problem. We had double-digit inflation, double-digit interest rates, and we had the Iranian hostage crisis, humiliating us and emblemizing our weakness in the world. Reagan came in, he had, thank God for him, he had Paul Volcker dealing with inflation. He dealt with a lot of this stuff rather quickly. He had the Iranians wanted to get the hostages out anyway. They gave them to him. A lot of good breaks. But he did big things, like he broke the PATCO strike right off the bat, right around this time. Remember the PATCO strike? They went out on a wildcat. They broke their contract. He nailed them. You don't come back to work, you're fired. Now, that's not a very liberal thing to do, obviously, but they heard it in Moscow. Dwayne Andrews came back and told Tip O'Neill, those communists over there got the message. This guy's different. He's tough. He's to be reckoned with. This is not a weak president we got here. And so Reagan did big things, and that's what the public wanted him to do. And here we go again, the cycle again. Big crisis, big recession, big decision. We pick somebody just like a former actor we would normally not have picked. We picked Barack Obama. Big crisis, big decision, and now big changes. And everybody that tries to fight the big change, oh, we'll just go down the middle and cut taxes a little and cut spending a little and get rid of earmarks and blah, 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 is off base. The country's in a mood for change. They're a little nervous, and they have a mixed feeling about all this action. But generally, if you look at all the polls up till this weekend, the public wants action. They sense the economy's still dipping down. It could get worse. They want to see some serious action by the federal government. And so I think that we're part of a cycle of history right now. As I said at the beginning, this is an exciting time because we're in a time of experimentation. And I think the country is always, in the long run, a little bit center-right, American politics. It's a little bit to the right of center, generally speaking. In times of crisis, it goes a little bit left of center. And then when things calm down again, it goes back a little bit right of center. That's sort of where we are. I think that's true north in this country. Laissez-faire if things are working all right, action if things aren't working right. We tend to go back. In a couple years, we'll be back to a more middle of the road. Right now, a little left to center, a little more action. People want the action right now. I think Barack Obama is very smart to start selling the fact he's for fiscal responsibility eventually. But not now. You know, St. Augustine, remember? Lord, save me, but not now. Is that Protestant too? It's Catholic, I don't know. Anyway, so we have this thing going on right now, and I think it's interesting to watch these three these sort of propositions I have. Lincoln, Reagan, Chicago. Watch Chicago. Chicago's a big part. Watch this Rahm Emanuel character. Boy, is he tough. And they run it like a tough big city government. You're either in or you're out, and everybody's out. There is no other party. There is no other party. So check me on this the next couple of months. If you see him referencing or having big meetings with Mitch McConnell, big meetings where they get the cameras in there and play up Mitch McConnell, build him up, I'm wrong. I think he'll probably play down Mitch McConnell and play down. And the irony is he is having all the cooperation he wants from the nutbags on the other side because Rush Limbaugh loves this stuff. The walrus eats this up. He loves being the number one guy on the right. And Dick Cheney, he is the troll under the bridge. This guy is so miserable. He's got that snarl. I mean, he is a perfect villain. It's perfect for him. You don't want likable people like Arnold Schwarzenegger or people like that on the other side or Tom Ridge of Pennsylvania or anybody else coming along right now. I mean, he makes Rudy seem sweet. So anyway, I think it's perfect stagecraft. It's somewhat fun right now because we only have, I thought Lamar Alexander was so smart the other day in the New York Times. He said, you know, we don't really have our act together, but we don't need it together right now. The Republican Party couldn't be doing anything right now because we're still in the honeymoon stage. So right now, give them the chance to do what they can do, and we'll have plenty of time for the criticism next year. So I think we're going to go back. I think we'll still be a little pro-Obama next year, but we'll be moving back towards center by the end of next year. The next election, I think it's going to be about whether we're happy with this first family. I think Michelle has been a delight. I think she's handled it better than he has. She knows to dress up. She knows to look good. She knows that she's the first family. It is a major show. She understands what it's about. It's the first family in the White House. The Clintons never quite got this. We give them the house because we want them to be our emblems. It's not just a job. It's a position. And for ironic of all reasons, Michelle understands it's a position more than anybody I've seen. She understands the first family holds a position in our public life that's different than just having an apartment somewhere. You're supposed to replicate or emblemize the best we offer, raising kids in a positive way. The best education you give them, the best care you can give them, and focus on your responsibilities as adults and married people. They're good at it. So I think we're going to be proud of them on a personal basis. And again, the Clintons didn't get it. I don't think they're ever going to get it. Sorry. I'm not really that interested. Now, I think one other thing that's going on right now is a lot of people invested in this campaign. The media, too, people like me invested in them, believed in them. And I think that's probably, Machiavelli was right. He said that the people are more loyal to people they invest in than people who invest in them. Parents are incredibly invested in their children. Your kid can let you down. Your kid can be crazy. You can worry about him every night of your life. And in the end, you care more and invested more than the kid can possibly be in himself. And so I think a secretary who works for a boss for 30 years is incredibly loyal to the boss. The more you give, the more you invest. Machiavelli figured this out 500 years ago. When your fields are burnt, your cattle stolen, you're more loyal to the prince than you ever were because you invested in him. And so I think the country is invested in this guy at the margin, 60% or so. And that's going to be healthy for him in the next year. You'll have those people invested in him. They want him to make it. Not just African Americans, liberals, a lot of other people want this guy to make it. We don't want a failed presidency. We will. In my business, I get paid every night to catch these guys and nail them. So I have that weird thing in my head. I got to catch them every night, but I'm hoping they do better than expected. So it's an interesting life I got. I'm very lucky to have the job I have. And only in this country can you have a job like mine, which is to say what you think. Pretty much. I get in trouble. But it's great to be here tonight and I think that this is the premier place in the world for the study of the American presidency, the Miller Center. And I do think that it's going to get bigger and bigger in the years to come. We are becoming more history conscious. The country is getting older and it's getting to treasure its past as well as its future. And we begin to look upon our presidents as really the emblem of our time. We live in the time of Harry Truman. We all remember those times. I don't quite remember it. We remember Eisenhower more positively than we did at the time. He's growing on me. Kept us out of a few wars. And I think that that here you have the chance to honor American history in a very clear way through its presidents. We don't remember the speakers of the House. We don't remember the vice presidents even. But we remember our presidents who guide us through all this. And I do think that right now we have a fascinating period of history. And luckily for Barack Obama, nothing really bad has happened, surprisingly. We haven't had 9/11. We haven't had really a Katrina yet, although swine flu is out there. I think they're showing that they're on top of dealing with that. But we do live in an incredibly interesting time. And I think that we'll be all, if we live a few more years, we'll be able to say, well, that was interesting and seemed to work out. And this country works. It does manage to achieve what it has to. I think there's two things that make this country different than any other country in the world. One is, it's a country you can still come to and become an American. You can, every ethnic group that's ever come to America, every ethnic group has done better here than where they came from. This is a country where you can do well as an individual. You can remake yourself. You can become who you want to be and what you want to be. You don't have to be who your grandfather was. My favorite example is the guy named Archibald Leach, who was a stilt walker on Coney Island. And he made $5 a day during the week and $10 a day on weekends. And all he ever wanted to do was become an American actor. And he went to regional theater. And he went down to St. Louis to the Muni Theater down there. And he played a guy named Cary Lockwood. And he liked that name. And then he thought, why don't I take that name Grant? That's a good name. And he became Cary Grant. You can't do that anywhere else. He said, everybody wants to be Cary Grant. Even I want to be Cary Grant. You can do that here. There's a guy named Ralph Lifshitz. Not a pretty name. He was up in the Bronx in the 70s. He's a schmata. He's in the rag business. He goes into a warehouse one day in the 70s, and he sees a bunch of old material, and he says, why don't I make those into ties? And remember the 70s, how awful men dressed, especially on golf courses? I mean, really awful. especially if they weighed too much, they would wear incredibly wild costumes. Well, men all wore, if you go back at the pictures, we had sideburns in the 70s, and we had huge ties. Well, Ralph Lipschitz came up with those ties. And later on, he became so successful that he began to teach new money how to dress like old money, to dress real American. His name is Ralph Lauren. And so you can do that in America. His Tom Brokaw once said, we were going up to his headquarters up on the 76 in Madison. He said, oh, you're going to the Temple of Assimilation. Everybody comes out a WASP. So only in America. So we are very good at accepting people. We are, and South Asians are coming to this country now. We're going to make this country, a lot of them. You watch those people. They're amazing. In the high-tech industry here in Virginia, it's extraordinary. And the other thing we have going for is that we adapt. We see a crisis. We make a big decision. And we resolve it. We do not get stuck in the mud like Europe has, or Japan has, or Canada has, or most of the other countries in this hemisphere. We're not a stuck-in-the-mud country. We see a challenge like smoking, for example. Most Americans have quit smoking, overwhelmingly, because they was told it will kill you. Well, other countries, they don't quit. They just keep going along. They keep doing it, and they think it's cool. This country adapts. We are a country that's protean. We grow, and we learn, and we adapt to new circumstances. There's something about this nature of this country that that works, and I think we're doing it again. Thank you very much.
Chris, with this crowd, you don't have to hold back. You can tell them what you really think.
We're on tape. Never forget you're on tape.
I'm going to move to the back of the room, and I invite those who have questions to queue up. Let me start by asking one other question about Barack Obama. Some people say he's the ultimate pragmatist. Some say he's an ideologue. Some people say he's an ideologue in a pragmatist's clothing. How would you classify him?
Well, I think that's something of a work in progress. I think we see a couple of compromises. For example, if you think he's a statist, he believes in economic control of major industries, why has he not touched the financial industry, really? He's going after autos, but he won't apply that to financial institutions. He's been very wary of doing that. And so I think that just when you think you've got him nailed, on national health, he's now saying affordable national health. That's a step back from free. You know, they don't say affordable in England or Canada. They say you get it. So he's saying affordable, which means everybody has to kick in a copay. He's, I think he's going to try to work against type. Every time we think he's a big government guy, he's going to try to back off it a bit. So I would say that in terms of fiscal policy, you'd have to say he's a liberal. But then again, because we'll have a bigger debt, I am afraid that by 2013, we'll have a debt of $13 trillion, which is the same as our GDP is now, which is pretty scary. Can we carry that debt servicing without having the middle class who pay most of the taxes in this country paying just for debt servicing? No one's going to get anything out of that except the T-bond holders. Now, if you're just into a very cautious investment strategy, maybe you're better off that way. You'll just have your bond as bond holders, you'll be in good shape. But we'll be basically taxing the middle class younger people to give interest to people who have saved in their whole life and have earned it back through saving. But I'm not sure that's going to build support for a federal government. I do worry about debt servicing. My daughter is at University of Pennsylvania. She's a member of a group called CYA, Concerned Youth of America, and this bipartisan group, and they're very worried about the debt they're going to inherit. So I think that's going to be big government, that part of it. The expansion of the money supply, printing money, that's a little dangerous. I don't know whether it's something you have to do at a time of deflation, but yeah. So I think there's only one way to describe the guy. He's a liberal. And how pragmatic a liberal he is, we'll find out. But definitely he will go down with Johnson and Roosevelt. I think he's in that direction. I think that's the answer.
Chris, thank you. I'm going to refer back to one of your opening statements with regards to democracy. The Palestinians were also told that democracy is the way to go. And they did. By over 70% of the population, they selected Hamas. And today, we don't talk to Hamas because Israel doesn't talk to Hamas. They don't talk to Hamas because they don't recognize Israel, and Israel doesn't recognize them. My basic question is, Obama has selected George Mitchell, which I think is probably the only person who might be able to do it. But do you think that George Mitchell can bring the two sides together? Thank you.
You like Mitchell because he's Lebanese, right?
Partially.
Yeah, come on. I got your number completely. You're pro-Arab. I know what's going on here. What is this? You think it's a masquerade here? I know what you're selling. Here's the problem with your argument. You skipped one little problem. Hamas doesn't recognize Israel, so why should Israel talk to him? I'm not talking about us. Why should Israel talk to him?
It's a two-way street. We have
Look, they don't recognize Israel. They call it the Zionist entity. They don't want to negotiate. When they want to negotiate, look, here's the answer. Hamas joins the government, which is dominated by Fatah, by Mahmoud Abbas. The United States compromises and says you can have some cabinet ministers who are Hamas and don't recognize Israel, as long as the government as a whole recognizes Israel. That's the solution, sir. If that happens, there can be a deal. Mitchell can make that happen. Right, thank you. But I think you gotta be, I'm very tough sometimes on Likud governments too, but I think in this case, I think Israel has had a hard time dealing with Hezbollah and its rocket attacks from the north, and Hamas with what it's been up to. I do think even if somebody on the right like Netanyahu has a point, which is you can't have a two-state solution based on a fourth world country living next door to a first world country. You can't have poverty and people sitting around just killing time on one side of the border and very industrious Israelis on the other side of the border living in a first world society. And the other society is a fourth world society. It'll do nothing but hell. Netanyahu, maybe for his own motives, says, no, you got to develop economically the West Bank before you give it its independence, because if you don't, it'll just be another left-wing, crazy, terrorist government. Only if they get a stake. Years ago, Shimon Peres said to me, his only hope as an Israeli was that the middle class of the Arab world in the West Bank would develop a stake in peace, like the Egyptians. I just spent a week in Egypt with my wife 2 weeks ago. They want peace. They do not want war. They want the Arabs on the West Bank to cut a deal with Israel so that they won't be the only Arab country that stuck its neck out. They don't love Israel. They don't even think it should be there. But they're pragmatic about it. And Bibi's going to have to be pragmatic, too. And those settlements should stop building. He keeps building. They keep kicking those Arabs out of their homes in the middle of the night at 4:45 in the morning. If you're going to do something, why are you doing it at 4:45 in the morning? You know, that's where your side's right. And I know what side that is. But thank
you. From one Tar Heel to another, a question. In having this quick-witted imagination that now imagine that President Chris Matthews is in his first 100 days. What one thing would you change that Obama should not have done, and what one thing would you would want to have happened if you, in your first 100 days as President Chris Matthews, which I've heard suggested before?
Well, I would have been more Irish. I don't think I would have picked Hillary, okay? Now, maybe that would have been a mistake, but I definitely don't think I would have been as magnanimous. I would be more of a, you know, Irish Alzheimer's, you know? All you remember, your enemies. I don't know. I think that I think the cabinet could have been better. And I do think that Geithner was a mistake. And I think if you're going to pick Larry Summers, pick him and stop this masquerade of picking him and putting him in the back room. take the heat from some women over that fight, get it over with, it'll be 2 weeks, and then move on.
Amen.
Stop being afraid of picking the people you ought to pick. Do what you, I always believe your hunches are right. They may be wrong, but in the end, they're right. Because even if you're wrong with a hunch, it's your hunch. Politicians get in trouble when they do things that's not their hunch. Kennedy was sort of forced into Vietnam because he said, I don't want to fight in Laos. So he said, I'll fight in Vietnam. This guy's fighting in Afghanistan, but he said, I didn't want to fight in Iraq. Whenever you let yourself be backed into a position that ain't yours, that's when the trouble comes. But when Kennedy said, let's get this country moving again with economic growth, that was a hunch. Go with your hunches. Barack Obama had a hunch. The Iraq war was a mistake. That was his hunch, and he stuck with it. And it's going to be always right, because it's what he believes. I think the trouble with presidencies is you only can follow your hunch on a few issues, then you got to do everything everybody else does. And you have to do things that, you know, like the banking industry. The guy doesn't have a hunch. Maybe he doesn't have a clue. I don't know what he has, but it ain't a hunch. He would prefer anything but talking about the banking industry. You can tell. So I would have picked the smartest guy I knew and or woman and listened to him and made him and fight for him. I think that this, this stickiness over taxes is an embarrassment. Going at auditing people because they're up for office. Why do you audit somebody? Is there a crime? Is there an assumption of evil? The guy or woman agrees to be a cabinet secretary, the first thing you do is audit them. I'm sorry. If they have any tax problems, fine. If they don't have any tax problems, move on. What are you looking for trouble for? Why are we looking for trouble? If we want nobody to be in the government, or we want St. Francis to be in our cabinet, fine. I just think we're just looking for trouble. We're looking for perfection. And maybe everybody disagrees with you on this. I just absolutely think we're just looking for trouble. I think we have nobody working for Geithner now at Treasury because they can't pass muster. Nobody wants these jobs. Who would give up a CEO job at a major corporation right now to go through a bunch of guys on the Hill who can't wait to catch them, who can't wait to humiliate them? Hey, I'm making 160 a year. Screw you. You know, that attitude. You know, I just think it's trouble. I think perfectionism, I say this to my wife like every hour. The perfect is the enemy of the good. The perfect is the enemy of the good. We don't have a first-rank cabinet now because everybody's been scared off from government. And I think auditing is what we all fear. And the first thing, oh, great, you want to be my Secretary of State? Your audit's coming. Let's go back 5 years and see what we can find. I have an attitude about this. I just think people like Ron Kirk were humiliated over stupid things. I thought that Geithner was over stupid things. I think Daschle did something wrong. He should have definitely not had that. Anybody has a guy shows up in the morning, he's your chauffeur. Well, that's nice. That's called income. You know, that is income. I disagree. That one was his problem. And he shouldn't have done it. But I think a little too much perfectionist, a little too much Simon Pure. No lobbyists in government. Well, what's that prove? You know, I don't know what that proves. Obviously, you all disagree with me because you're all better people. But
you mentioned very quickly who you said you think was the best president or your favorite president.
Lincoln and Roosevelt, yeah.
Okay.
And Washington. I mean, they're the big three.
All right. And why do you think that? And how do you?
Well, Washington because Washington was the role model. And I was just there this weekend in Mount Vernon. And what Washington did was define the presidency in a way that the Constitution writers couldn't have done, that Madison couldn't have done, which was to recognize that it's in many ways, a noble office. You're not, as I said a half hour ago, it's not just a job. You are our representative of our people, not just our country. In fact, what got to me on inaugural day was the 21-gun salute, when I realized this black guy was our president, not just our head of government, but he's our head of state. That's pretty dramatic stuff. And Washington figured out that the most important thing he could do at the end of his second term was to go back home to Mount Vernon. When he was leading our fight against the British Empire, which is still the most amazing story in our history, was defeating the British Empire, when they had everything, and we had nothing, really. And when he decided, George III, who was not a bad guy, really, was getting his portrait painted by an expat. And he said, what do you think Washington's going to do after the war? And he said, well, I think he's going back to his farm. And then George III said, well, then he'll be the greatest man in the world. So I think setting that standard of going back after having power and relinquishing what he could have had, which is a dictatorship, was the most important message. Walking away from power is something they can't do in Africa to this day. Most people in the world don't know how to walk away from power. I'll be lucky. Do you think Putin's walked away from it? I mean, they don't walk away. It's not human nature. But Americans said, no, we are different. We're a protean country that has to move forward, and we're going to have our leaders leave when the time comes. I think Lincoln, because of, I was just reading James McPherson's book, Tried by War, that struggle to find a good general till he finally found Grant. Just trying to find a general. You know, these battles here in Virginia where he'd say, look, if you're not going to use your army, give it to me, and I'll use it, you know, to McClellan and to Hooker and those guys and Burnside. They just couldn't win the war. They were just afraid. And he found this guy, this incredible character, and he finally found his person, and he won the war. I think, imagine when you had to take the presidency, and they're already threatening Fort Sumter, and the country's coming apart. And the easy answer would have been, let him go. And he said, no, we're going to fight for the Constitution. Now, maybe he was wrong to fight for the war, but the fact that he did, this is a great country. I'm not sure we'd be a great country if we'd be split in half right now. I'm not sure. I think the North liberalism was good for the South, and the South's conservatism has been good for the North. I think it's a good match.
You've described.
I love being grand.
You've described Obama's first 100 days, and they sound rather impressive. Looking at the other side, the GOP's first 100 days, what can we say? You've described the embarrassments
of... Lamar Alexander says that the stakes are high.
That's the question.
Well, Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who's kind of a moderate conservative, said that the stakes aren't that high because the other side's going to get its 100 days. I don't think it's shown much. But I don't think it's their turn. I think their turn will come... Michael Steele's having a very hard time losing that race in upstate New York last week and losing in Minnesota. Apparently, that's coming. Pawlenty's probably going to throw in the towel on that one and allow Al Franken to come to the Senate. Be interesting. I think young guys like Cantor from Richmond are to be watched for a lot of reasons. No, he's a hot shot. He's a hot shot. And he's another Newt, I think, another Newt Gingrich. I think that they've got some great... But I think the Democrats have got a better crowd right now. I think people I'm in love with are like Wasserman Schultz. I just love some of these people. I just love her. She's going through breast cancer and everything, and she hasn't missed a beat. She was down there with the Birmingham thing with me a couple months ago. I mean, she just is great. And I just love people that have the guts to talk. You know, and let's see who else I like. I like her. I fall in love occasionally. Wasserman Schultz. I like Pat Buchanan, too. He's great. He plays the role on my show that the Washington Generals used to play with the Globetrotters. Those are the white guys that always lost, you know. He believes what he believes. This guy is right wing. Deep down, Pat Buchanan. He's charming about it, but God help you.
In the campaign last year, you made a statement that was widely reported by the media, correctly or incorrectly, I'm not sure.
No, it's correct.
But
the media is generally correct.
The statement, as I recall
it... Was this going to be the throw up my leg, or is this Hillary only got there because her husband messed around? Which one do you like the most?
This was a statement that every time Barack Obama spoke, you got a particular thrill.
No, I didn't say that.
And...
getting a thrill right now, aren't you?
What's the correct?
No, actually, I didn't say that. I said that after one of his really powerful speeches. It was after the Potomac primary, after Virginia, the night he won Virginia and Maryland and D.C. And he said something, because the thing about Barack Obama that inspires me, and I'm not that inspired by what he does, but by his words, they've always inspired me. And I'll tell you why. It seems like he addressed two issues that I care about. One is race relations in this country. And he's not some guy that comes out and says, I want a bigger piece of the pie from my crowd or something like that. He doesn't talk like that. He never, ever talks like that. I want a redivision of wealth or... He doesn't ever, because I don't think he believes in it that simply. I think he believes in opportunity and the way he got it, by work. And I'm inspired more than that time, sir. You want me to build it up? I I was in Philadelphia, North Philadelphia, a terrible neighborhood, if you've ever been there, North Broad, above Temple. It's terrible, and it's worse than it was 40 years ago. It's dangerous, it's just awful. And I was there 40 years ago on my way to the Peace Corps, and I went there to study minority businesses just to sort of get some hunch about how you do it, because I was going to teach business. And it's worse now. And yet, the morning he spoke there, about 2 weeks before the election, there was 15, 20,000 people there, mostly black, but mixed in together, very integrated crowd, very salt and pepper. 7 out of 8 people were black, and everybody else was having the greatest time in the world. And the line that won that crowd, which wins with me, was he said, I want to have a country that unites people, doesn't divide them. And that was the biggest applause. Not I'm going to give you jobs or welfare or programs, but I'm just going to let you be part of the country. You're going to be American. And I think he says things like that that just get to me. And I thought that speech he gave on race in Philadelphia was spectacular. And I think what he says a lot of times is spectacular. He also talked about us getting back into the world again and stop being the cowboy out there. And I'm with him. I'm inspired by him. But as for his politics, as for what he does day to day, I'll check it out, look at it. But I was inspired by his campaign, and I hope I was justified. I hope he turns out to be a great success. Chris, but my job's to catch him every night.
Chris, I think we all agree he's probably one of the most, if not the most, accomplished speaker we've had in the White House. My question is this. In view of the broken promises on earmarks, on fiscal restraint, on lobbyists, and some of the other his appointments in the cabinet that you've talked about.
No, I think he's going in your direction.
Do you still have the same thrill?
I said that I think he's been too good on lobbyists and vetting people. I think he's been too Simon Pure. As for earmarks, he didn't do anything about them in that first round. You're right. I caught him on that.
Chris, does the Obama administration think that Biden was a mistake, and does he have any role of any importance in this administration?
Do you think so?
Yeah, I think there were a great many more competent people who. I think he's a cipher.
No, I think I have a different theory. I think he plays a role of being the regular guy, who's our interlocutor with a guy who's not regular, who's a bit extraordinary. I think, and not to put him down, but I think he plays the role that Ed McMahon played with Johnny Carson. A regular guy who, the fact that he's nice to him means he'd be nice to us. I mean, I identify more with Joe Biden than Barack Obama. He's like me, grew up with a sports coat in the 60s, and he drove around, he's a regular guy. And I think he's much more like most people. And he makes mistakes, and he, like me, he talks when he shouldn't, and I think there's no game there. There's no guile. He's a wonderful father, and I think he's been a wonderful husband. And he went home every single night of his life when he was a senator, and that's why he was never considered a sophisticate, because he was a day hop. Every night he went home. Every single night he went back to Delaware. I mean, he shouldn't be canonized for this, but it does tell you about his values. I think he's what he is. Great dad. I've seen him up on Nantucket with his family at Thanksgiving. They always go up there, and I think he's what he is. And I think Barack is still a bit of a mystery to a lot of us. Like, we can't quite figure out this guy. He came out of nowhere. He went to Columbia. He went to Harvard Law. He was at Harvard Law Review. He's a senator when he's a kid. A little too wondrous for us, a lot of people. But they can figure out Joe Biden. And I think he made a mistake by kidding around about Judge Roberts' mistake. but that's harmless. I think his mistakes are harmless, but he brings a big heart. They love him. By the way, he's the guy that put the apostrophe in Obama, by the way, if you want to know. Because he helped him with my crowd in Scranton and places like that, which are real Hillary country. And when Biden showed up there in those neighborhoods that are working class Catholic, and they can identify with Joe Biden. He's very popular in the Northeast.
What do you think about the economy, and do you think Obama can fix it?
Can I ask you the same question? Come on, you wise guy. Do you think he can? Do you think he can? I don't know either. But we're all going to know, because there's one thing that's objective. We won't argue about it. If the economy gets better, he'll get credit. If it doesn't, he'll get blamed. And he's one of the few politicians I've ever met who's actually said that. He said, if it doesn't work, blame me. That's rare. We will, by the way. And I think he's doing... the textbook thing that we were taught in grad school to do. When consumer spending goes down, when business investment goes down, the government has to compensate for it. And he's doing that. I think printing of money, just creating money, is probably what you do. I think his goal was to inflate the money supply and raise, this is what I really think he's up to, raising real estate values. I think he knows that the minute housing values start to go up, every problem is solved. The mortgage is worth, it isn't cost you as much because the house is worth more than the mortgage. The people can start calling, taking phone calls from their banks. They can actually relate to the person they owe the money to. Everybody, Warren Buffett said, the number one problem we had is that everybody thought their housing values would keep going up. Therefore, you could always borrow more against it, you could refinance, and if the bank lost and you couldn't pay your thing, great, give me the house back, it's worth more now. Everybody was happy. We say we hate inflation. We hate a lot of inflation. A little bit of inflation we sort of like, 3 or 4%. And I think if we get back to something like that, housing values will be back up. I'm not sure we'll ever admit that. But if you see housing prices going up again in the next year, he'll be all right. If they keep going down, we got a problem, I think.
Please join me in thanking Chris Matthews. Thank you.